Good evening. Here we go again. This is TNT Radio, brought to you by Bloggin' Broadcasting Service, and I'm Nevin Campanella, your net reporter. Well, folks, you probably may have heard that two or three times. I'm not sure. I'm here in the station, and as everyone is aware, we have had major change in equipment, and it is improving on a daily basis. And as a matter of fact, within a day or two here, we're going to have this marvelous new mixer coming in, which ought to make things considerably better. Plus, some software is being purchased for broadcasting purposes, which will make the on and off air ability much easier. So we're getting some slick equipment, some slick software, and we are growing. So stay tuned to BBS Radio. Let's see. I have, before I even touch the news, I have a comment here. Something I ran into today, and it is called the wordbook.com. I was fast, folks, because the wordbook.com is an encyclopedia. Now, I have never heard of it before, and I don't roam around on the net very much. I really don't. I pretty much stick to the news sites or to the special sites that I might have to go to when I have a guest on What a World Radio, which, by the way, is on Sunday nights at 8 p.m. Sunday night's guest is going to be Lori Conrad. And as I recall, I think Lori is very much involved in communication with pets. However, let's talk about the wordbook.com. It is an encyclopedia, and, you know, I put in some search items. For instance, I pulled up March 30th, and it came up with an entire list the same as you might expect to get from you-know-who, our most favorite encyclopedia on the net, Wikipedia. I actually compared the information, and while some of the information was the same, there was a lot that was different. Now, how good is it? How bad is it? I don't have a clue. But I did notice one thing. For all, they don't talk about themselves very much on their website. As a matter of fact, they don't talk about themselves at all. I was rather amazed. Here's this huge search engine on an encyclopedia. And although there's a little bit of advertisement to the left and to the right, and I mean minimal, there is nothing about them. Absolutely nothing. So I went down to the bottom of the page, and I clicked on some kind of website information, whatever. It took me to a website that was in German. Aha. So I'm starting to wonder, is it possible that there is a connection between the wordbook.com and Wikipedia? There may be. I'm thinking maybe. It's hard to tell. You know, Wikipedia had so many problems over the past year with bad information. Maybe what they're doing is tossing something else out there as a distraction. I don't know. But I'm going to dig into it. I am going to dig into it. And I will keep you up to date as to what I find out. I'm not exactly an investigative reporter, except for finding out things on the net. But I will search. Now, you know, most of the news is not really very good. I mean, you always get news that is, oh, no, here we go again. We're being bombed. We're bombing somebody else. Another hurricane, more people dying, so on, and blah, 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 blah. Well, guess what? I'm going to read something to you that I consider the best news I have heard in a long time. And I mean a really long time. It sort of restores my faith in humanity. This takes place in San Francisco. The title is Hiker Returns Toronto's Family Purse. John Surhoff, quote, John Surhoff found the Louis Vuitton bag on a Sausalito park bench during a lunch stop in the scenic city following a weekend hike. Inside the bag, police say, was a treasure trove. A 12-carat diamond ring. Can you imagine 12-carat diamond ring? Pearl and emerald jewelry, a Cartier watch, and roughly $500 in Canadian and American cash. Now listen to this, folks. The entire contents, you know, the diamonds, et cetera, were worth a cool $1 million U.S. dollars. I cannot imagine why anybody would be walking around with $1 million worth of jewelry in their purse. And if you did, wouldn't you kind of have it like tied to your waist? They left it on a park bench for anybody to come by, pick it up, and go enjoy the rest of their life on the proceeds of that little purse. Now, fortunately, a respiratory therapist comes by, and he didn't think of heading to a pawn shop. He returned the bag to Sausalito Police Headquarters Monday afternoon after failing to track down the owners. The bag is en route now to the Gondahia family of Toronto, who were in Northern California for a daughter's wedding. I mean, this is absolutely amazing. John Surhoff is an amazing individual. And he says, quote, every person I know or associate with would have done the same thing, and I'm glad to be able to help, end quote. Well, thank you, Mr. Surhoff. You have restored my faith in humanity. I got to tell you, folks, I didn't believe there was any integrity or morality left on the face of this planet. I don't care whether you're talking about religious people or not. None of them. I didn't really think there was any left. But this man, this respiratory therapist, really has restored my faith in humanity. And he brought up a couple of issues in my mind. Essentially, integrity, ethics, and morality. Now, I got to give you a quote here from the son of the person who left the bag. His name is Ali. Quote, you have to be a real man to return that bag. Even the bag is expensive. We're really very thankful to that guy, end quote. I'm sure they are. A real man has integrity. A real woman has integrity. They have morality. They have ethics. You know, last night I spent almost the entire news hour talking about the Julius Rosenberg case. Well, tonight, guess what, folks? I'm going to talk about integrity and ethics. I was fascinated by what that man did, what that respiratory therapist did. So let's take a little look, first of all, at what we're talking about. Integrity and ethics. What are they? What do they really mean? Well, if we go into the dictionary, we find that integrity means moral soundness. And ethics is defined as a motivation based on ideas of right and wrong. Well, there's a lot in those two words, folks. A lot. Ethics, really, it's the discipline dealing with what is good and bad, and with moral duty and obligation. A set of moral principles or values. A theory or system of moral values. The principles of conduct conducting, governing an individual or group. It's a guiding philosophy. What are your ethics? Do you have them? Of course you do. You grew up with them. You have an entire list of them. You probably don't know what each of them are, but you've got them. Now, the concept of discipline or system, it implies making a judgment. Okay? It implies making a judgment. In ethics, there is no way to get away from making a judgment. But what we need is some sort of guideline as to what is being judged. The question then is either A, are we making a judgment about a person? Or B, are we making a judgment about a person's behavior? When we talk about ethics, we're talking about making judgments, a system. Now, A or B, are we judging a person or their behavior? These are two distinct and different issues. To make a judgment about a person borders on bigotry. And it's not really very useful in terms of organizing societal behavior. It really isn't, folks. You start judging the person rather than their behavior, and you're going to be knee-deep in some very difficult problems. All it does when you start judging people is it inflames emotions, and it has little to do with conduct. It's very likely that this is what is meant by the concept of, quote, judge not, lest ye be judged, end quote. We got to stop judging people, but we have to start judging behavior. You really got to keep those two apart. A more direct route to the answer is simply that the word ethics is in fact defined as conduct and not character or personality. When you start judging people, you're judging character and personality. We need to start judging conduct. For instance, let me give you an example. How do you feel about George W. Bush? That's a very open-ended question. You might say, oh, George W. Bush is a turkey. That really doesn't say very much, other than you don't have a whole lot of thought process about George W. Bush. But we can't judge his behavior. His behavior? He broke the law. That's right. With the wiretapping, he broke the law. It's quite simple. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this one out. He broke the law. We are judging his behavior. What behavior is that? His ethical behavior. His sense of ethics. And morality. His behavior says, he broke the law. He's not real high on the ethical level here. Okay, now, since we understand that we're judging behavior and not a person, with that issue later, we can state that ethics are the guiding philosophy about behavior. And behavior is something that is amenable to change. And if it's not governed, it can lead to some really chaotic living conditions. Imagine what our world would be like if everyone did their own thing. It'd be a tough place to live in. I know I hear people talk about anarchists and so on and so forth. What a bunch of baloney. People, knowing the basic level of people, you put them for 5 days on an empty belly, they'd be killing each other. Everyone's behavior from birth to death is judged by self, family, friends, and society. We're praised for behavior that is judged good, and chastised for behavior that is judged bad. George did a bad thing. He broke the law by wiretapping without getting a warrant. That's what he did. Now, this, of course, is the basis of child rearing. You praise good behavior, you chastise bad behavior. It's not real complicated. The child learns what is acceptable and what is not acceptable and makes behavioral adjustments accordingly. Now, this type of adjustment is called moral development, and it continues throughout our lives. Now, there was a very famous professor of psychology at Harvard University. His name is Lawrence Kohlberg. And he attempted to try to actually define stages of moral development. Now, another psychologist also did this. His name is Piaget. And he did it with children. Kohlberg took it a few steps further because he was talking about moral development at a level that probably goes just beyond children. He wasn't talking so much about the development itself, but where it might lead to. The first one we usually manage to complete without much difficulty in terms of moral development, the very first stage, that is simply understanding basic issues of behaving according to standards. If we don't, we're punished. That's a simple one. Level one, first step of moral development. Now, the second level is based on laws of society. Where the first level is based on the laws of our parents, the next level up is laws of society. We understand that if we violate these laws, then we risk the consequences of societal punishment, which might include being placed in jail. Do you think George W. Bush is going to go to jail? No way. It's not going to happen. Will he be impeached? I still doubt it. Why? Because there's so much game playing going on in Washington, D.C. Nobody's really concerned about his ethical issues. They're only concerned about posturing politically. What can they get out of it? If they can get more impeaching him, that's what's going to happen. That includes both the Democrats and the Republicans. Now, with most of us, we seem to make a moderate adjustment to the second level. Now, there is a small part of the population that never seems to make that second adjustment. In other words, they keep busting the law and getting thrown in jail. I guess at one time the law recognized that something was going to have to be done. That's why they came up with three-time felonies. You go in for the rest of your life. In level one, we control our behavior because we want to avoid punishment from our parent. In level two, we control our behavior as a function of our desire for social approval. At least most of us do. Now, it's the third level that Kohlberg suggested was achieved by only a few rare people. And who did he think achieved it? He suggested that the Buddha and Jesus Christ probably achieved the third level. Remember, we're talking about a very high level of moral development. Their concept of ethics was not based on consequence at all, but rather an internal mechanism, which Kohlberg described as understanding of social mutuality and a genuine interest in the welfare of others. Now, Kohlberg just plain did not believe that many adults ever achieved this level. The problem we face today in the modern world and in the third dimension is that most adults are functioning at level two and therefore run the risk of what is called situational ethics. Ah. Now we're getting down to the nitty-gritty of the problem, folks. Situational ethics. Believe me, it runs rampant across the planet. Not just in Washington, D.C. Many, many of us are guilty of situational ethics. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, as the situation changes, with a lot of people, their ethics change, making them extremely undependable and usually characterized as self-serving. That's right. Situational ethics means that your ethics change and they're loose and they change as the situation changes. So if there is a cost to you, a high cost of something, and you can stop that cost by changing your ethics, you will. Now, here's a good example. If I have no food, it is okay to steal. If I go without, I can take it from others. If I don't like the laws of the land, I can just violate them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Onward and onward and onward and onward. I actually ran into an individual on the net one day who objected to my discussion of ethics and what was necessary to achieve a better world. This individual characterized the coming world, the end of the world as we know it, folks. You know the kind of person I'm talking about. As a situation in which every man for himself, kill or be killed, dog eat dog. I'm telling you, this person really believed what he was saying and thought that what I was saying was, oh, just academic and countless. It's the people like that that make up the majority of our world, I'm sad to say. Now, we did find out from that very first article that there are a few people out there that don't fall into that crap. But there's not many. No, there isn't. There's some. Hold on to that thought, because it's hope for the rest of us. Now, in terms of moral development, level one, that is, you're looking at your parents and you do right or wrong based on whether or not you can be punished by them. And level two, seeking approval from society, both those two levels fail to recognize that we are all one. And it maintains an illusion of separateness. As long as you're in level one or two, you're going to maintain that illusion of separateness. In other words, you're going to be punished by your parents or society. Somehow you're not a part of it. It does this by providing us the illusion of a victim and victimizer. Now, in the third dimension, we've often seen this type of ethics in the business world. We see it all the time. It's constant. And, you know, it even comes with a name. Yeah, that's right, folks. It comes with a name. It's called being a good horse trader. Ooh, what could that mean? Walk onto a used car lot and find out. Now, some of us had this experience in the purchase of a used car. The salesperson might consider themselves ethical and virtuous, and yet have no compunctions about stealing you blind in some car trade. Why? They were raised that way, folks. We were all raised that way. Many of us were. Some of us know. Most service-to-self people believe that ethics are a process of mutual realization. Whoa, what does that mean? Most service-to-self people believe that ethics are a process of mutual realization. That is, if both individuals involved in a transaction realize all necessary information, then both adhere to ethical principles. In other words, if someone else is aware, then ethical principles become impeccable. In other words, if someone's watching you, you ain't going to do something wrong. However, this is the tough part, folks. Should one of the participants lack all necessary information or make a mistake, then it is considered smart to take advantage. Now, in terms of ethics, the question is one of responsibility. Are we responsible for another person's error in judgment? Hell no, we're not. You are not responsible for another person's error in judgment. The Christians might tell you you are, but I'm telling you folks, you're not. The answer is no. We are not responsible for the error. However, we certainly are responsible for letting the other person know all the facts so they can make a correction. Now, this admits to the law of one, which is separateness is an illusion. A simple example is one we have all encountered at one time or another in a grocery store. The clerk gives you back too much change or undercharges for a particular item. Now, even the service itself person is usually honest enough to declare the error because there's very little personal cost. Doesn't matter. I mean, it's so minimal. The service itself person just doesn't care. However, as personal cost increases, service to self ethics are prone to change. Now we're getting close to situational change, situational ethics. As the personal cost increases, the ethics are more prone to change. If it is a matter of winning or losing a job because another person's error, such as a misspelled word on a job application, the SDS is not very likely to announce to a competitor that they have placed themselves at a disadvantage. So then how do we achieve? Well, folks, achievement should be based on strategy and not capricious errors of those who are less aware. You want to remain ethical, then that's how you approach it. You base your achievement on strategy and not on the error of others. For instance, in a game of chess, you would not remain silent while your opponent plays themselves in a checkmate situation when other moves are available. The checkmate should occur because your strategy has removed all other options. So how do we get past two? How do we get past level two of moral development? There is an answer. I seriously doubt whether very many of you have taken the time to sit down and write a generic list of ethics. Guess what? I did. I sure did. Now, in all honesty, I'm giving to you tonight what I had originally written, or started to write, probably about 5 years ago. It came about as a process of having been involved in a forum that was being operated by Michael St. Clair. And if you've listened to my show on Saturday, last Saturday he was on. I also had him on Water World Radio on Sunday nights. But Michael was running a forum, and it was kind of a very lively forum, extremely lively. Anyway, as a process of the questions and everything else coming up, it seemed obvious that the board was screaming for, okay, what do we do about conduct? Do we actually have principles of conduct? So I said, well, I don't know, but I'm going to try to write some. And I did. Now we have to make some distinctions here. Principles of conduct. These are expected behaviors within a populace. A law tells a person what not to do, but it doesn't define what to do. It just tells you don't do this. It doesn't stop, but it doesn't tell you what to do instead. Principles of conduct do exactly that. They tell you what to do. Principles of conduct are based on ethical principles, whereas laws are based on special interests or capricious concepts of morality. Now, unlike laws, principles of conduct are not enforced, and they are intended only as guidelines. For for generating harmony when a group setting. Now, they are not etiquette. Unlike etiquette, they are fixed and applies regardless of how a situation might change. Etiquette is much different. Keep that in mind, folks. Etiquette demands different behavior under different situations. It expects you to change. Whereas ethics should never, never, never change. So what are, I came up with some. I came up with 10 of them. Everybody always comes up with 10. They never come up with 9. It seems like we always want to achieve 10. And I remember the movie 10. As a matter of fact, I mentioned it on a couple of shows ago, the movie 10. Well, I came up with 10. And the very first one, makes so much sense, you would think that everybody would think of it. Real simple. Do no harm. Isn't it simple, folks? Your very first principle of conduct is do no harm. And that's been around for a long time. Medical doctors, when they take their oath, the Hippocratic Oath, some people call it the hypocritical oath. No, it's the Hippocratic Oath. Part of that oath is do no harm. In other words, don't make things worse. Don't do that. Do no harm. Okay, that's a no, but it's not a law. The assumption here is you're going to do something other than that. Now, the next one gets more down to behavior. Number two. Remember, these are just from me. This is what I came up with, and I try to live my life by them. In all interactions with animate and the inanimate, strive to maintain mutual dignity. Now, is that so hard? You don't have to go clomping through a forest and breaking off leaves and twigs. There is a dignity for the tree and the forest. There is a dignity to animals. There's a dignity to rocks and a stream. Is it so absurd to ask an individual to strive to maintain mutual dignity between yourself and the rest of the planet? That's what we're talking about. How do you maintain mutual dignity, for instance, with a river? Well, for one, you don't crap at it. That's not a good thing to do. You don't walk through a forest chopping down trees. Strive to maintain mutual dignity. Do something to help the growth of the tree. Do something to help the purity of the stream. Do something to help the animals you encounter. It's not so hard. So number one is do no harm. Number two, in all interactions with the animate and the inanimate, remember, inanimate is in there. That's, you know, rocks and things like that. Strive to maintain mutual dignity. That is not asking a whole lot. Now, number three. The infirm of mind, body, or circumstance are the mirrors of the soul. They are, folks. It's us. The person you see who is in a bad circumstance or who has an ill body or is not quite mentally capable, we're all one. That person is us. It's me. It's the big I. So, great care must be given to them to ensure the mirror's reflective quality. Think about that, folks. The infirm of mind, body, or circumstance are the mirrors of the soul. Now, take great care so that you ensure the mirror's reflective quality. Because if you don't, folks, if the mirror's blurred, it becomes fogged over. We're going to have a lot of sad people on this planet. Number four. It is the responsibility of each citizen to speak out against injustice and imbalance. That's possibly one of the things I attempt to do with this microphone on TNT Radio. You know, when I see injustice or what it appears injustice to me or imbalance, I try to speak about it. And I don't do it just in terms of you know, the national figures. I do it with my family. I do it with my friends. I do it with my coworkers. If it don't look right to me, I say, hey, this is not right. This is an injustice. It's imbalanced. There's something wrong. Now, folks, you have to take the responsibility to do that. Yeah, sometimes it's uncomfortable. It could be very uncomfortable with a friend or a family member. Number five, provide aid, comfort, and a secure haven for the sacred church. Now, what am I saying, folks? Come on. Provide aid, comfort, and a secure haven for the sacred traveler. What is sacred about a traveler? All travelers are sacred because it's us. Am I the first person saying it? Come on. Remember the story of the Good Samaritan? That's what it's all about. You have a traveler in front of you. They are sacred. Give them aid, comfort, and a safe place. How tough is that? How tough is that? Come on. Number six, constructive presentation of solicited and unsolicited judgment. What the hell does that mean? You know, if you're telling somebody that something is wrong without giving them the solution, it's not going to do a whole lot. Then you're going to sound like a nag. If you're going to make a judgment about something, then present a constructive criticism. Present the alternative. How can we do things differently? Make it constructive. Not a big deal. If I say to you, boy, your shoes look really funny, I probably should add to that, oh, and by the way, you got the left foot on the right foot and vice versa. Make it constructive. Tell them how to change it. Number seven. This one is tough for a lot of people. Actually, this one is tough for me. It's called allow and accept. Whoa. You know, if we only had that one principle, allow and accept, we'd sure have a whole lot less problems on this planet. Unfortunately, there are many groups, both political and religious, that neither allow nor accept anything but their own opinion. It's called bigotry. But it is hard. I mean, it really is. Because there are a lot of things that might annoy me. And I have to look at it and say to myself, well, wait a minute, this is none of my business. This is up to the individual. It's their choice. It's their lifestyle. For instance, some people object. I don't know why. But they object to homosexual behavior. Homosexual lifestyle. I don't have a clue as to why. What the hell business is it of mine how consenting adults want to engage in sex? I mean, it makes absolutely no sense in my brain. Now, I might have a whole lot to say if my neighbor was storing bazookas in his basement, but not if he's homosexual. Why would I care? Why would I care? Some people seem to make it their business not to allow anything. But like I said, it's hard even for me. I mean, it's not easy for me to just easily open that up. My wife, Jill, taught me a lot about that. Jill has got to be the most accepting individual I have ever met in my entire life. And she taught me a lot about that one, allow and accept. And that's one I still got to work on. Eight, joyful acceptance and completion of responsibilities. You know, if somebody accepts a job, a chore, and all they do is bitch about it, then what's the point? You're making everybody's life miserable. Accept and complete it joyfully. Do I do that all the time? No, I don't. I fall off on that one too. Not all the time. I'm getting better at it. I am getting pretty good at it. But do it joyfully. If you accept it, in other words, if you say, yeah, I will do this, keep a smile on your face. Oh, you don't feel like smiling? That's okay. I guarantee you, If you keep the smile there long enough, eventually you're going to feel like smiling. 9. Maintain regard for others' sense of esteem and competence. You know, you're right. It seems like lately I run into a lot of people that seem to have a lot of self-esteem, especially on the air. Maintain regard for that sense. No matter what you think of it, it's them. That's the real them. Whether you think of it, it's overblown or underblown. Maintain a regard for it. Keep in mind, folks, that the person you're talking about, the person you dislike, is you. That's right. We're all one. When you point a finger, you got 3 pointing back at you. Try it. Point a finger right now. Notice there's 3 more pointing back at you in the palm of your hand. Maintain regard for others' sense of esteem and competence. And finally, the last one, number 10. I like this one the most. See the joy of creation and the humor of self-importance. I love that one. I absolutely love that one. Because there's, I see the joy of creation. I mean, living here in paradise, you can't miss it. I mean, every time I look out the window, I'm faced with it. Some of you just plain do not live in a pretty area like I live in. I'm blessed. I am absolutely blessed. I have never seen anything like this. The second side of that, the humor of self-importance, it's really funny. I mean, you know, you come across these people whose sense of self is so overblown, it just kind of blows you away, you know. It is humorous. But see it in yourself. How self-important am I? How self-important is Nevin? Am I real important? You know what? If the universe decides to unplug me from life within the next 10 minutes, right after the end of this show, not one damn thing will change on this planet. Nothing. Except maybe my friends might have a party. I'm sure that my wife and Don and Doug would pull out a couple of beers. They know I like pizza, and they'd have some of that. But that's about it, folks. When you go, you're gone. Boom. What does it mean? What am I saying to you? Well, first of all, don't take life too seriously. I don't want to get dramatic here, but my own has been on edge for quite a long time. And I count each moment. I look at it. I mean, I really do, folks. I lose my temper, sure. I get annoyed. But then I always get back to, my God, I woke up this morning. I can see my beautiful wife. One of these days, it's not going to happen. See that joy of creation. Live each moment as if it were your last. Because it can be. It could very well be. Think about it. Look at the clock. Do you know what's going to happen to you 10 seconds from now? I know it's going to happen right now. I am out of time. I love you all. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.